Well, good morning. Join me in your Bibles in Luke chapter 22 this morning. We'll be looking at beginning in verse 39, but kind of just to put things in context. They've left the upper room where they observed the Lord's Supper and had observed the last Passover. And the Lord gives some encouraging words to his disciples, and much of the details of what goes on is recorded in John chapter 14, 15, 16, and the Lord's high priestly prayer there in John chapter 17, but in our account here in Luke, beginning in verse 39, and he came out and went as he was wont to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, pray that ye enter not into temptation. And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast, and he kneeled down and prayed, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me, nevertheless not my will, but thine be done. And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he arose up from prayer and was come to his disciples, he found them sleeping for sorrow, and said, why sleep ye? Rise and pray, lest ye enter into temptation. And these are the last things recorded in Luke before the Judas and his henchmen show up to arrest him there. And so we're going to pay particular attention today. We're going to kind of hop around through this in a little bit and circle back on some other things our next lesson. But today's lesson, the title of today's lesson is In the Garden Again. And it says he went as he was wont to do, and that means his custom, his habit, and the determinate counsel of God would be the reasons why Christ retreated to this Mount of Olives every evening after teaching in the temple. And you know, Judas knew that he did that. It was he could count on that, and we find that in John chapter 18, verse 1 and 2. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where was a garden, into the which he entered, and his disciples. And Judas also, which betrayed him, knew the place, for Jesus oft times resorted thither with his disciples. So Judas had kind of bugged out before they went over there, but he knew where they were going, because it says that he went there every day. He taught in the temple by day and went to the Mount of retreated to the Mount of Olives by night. And in Matthew chapter 26 verse 36, we have a little more detail supplied, because it says, then cometh Jesus with him to a place called Gethsemane, and saith unto the disciples, sit ye here while I go and pray yonder. So the Mount of Olives is called a Sabbath day's journey from Jerusalem. The amount of the tradition of the elders, this was the distance that they were allowed to walk in a day without violating the Sabbath. So it was just a not that far, but a little bit of a walk. And the Mount of Olives was noted for olive groves. And on the west side, facing Jerusalem, it was like a big cemetery. And I read yesterday there's about 150,000 graves and tombs there, if you can believe that. And remember, when people came for the Passover, they would go out and they would whitewash all those tombs, because if you touched where a dead person was, you touched a tomb, you were unclean for 7 days, and you wouldn't be able to participate in any of the festivities and the Passover or any of the feasts that they were having. So they would go out and whitewash those tombs so people would know where they were. They wouldn't accidentally touch them or sit on one or come in contact with them, because it would make them ceremonially unclean. And so there you have the whited sepulchres connotation that you find. Jesus says, you're like whited sepulchres. You look pretty nice on the outside, but you're full of dead men's bones within. And John, again, he describes this on this Mount of Olives. There was a garden called Gethsemane. And since it was a place where there was a lot of olive groves, in this, the Gethsemane means olive press. And so very, there's so much things that we find are significant here with just a little bit of digging, that it's just, there's nothing in there by accident. Everything has a purpose. Everything has a quality to it that speaks to the Lord and his redemption of the church. And, you know, we find, it was just kind of came to me as interesting that the second Adam, for the last time, enters into a garden to undo all the grief caused by the first Adam in the first garden. Isn't that an interesting corollary that we find there, where Christ goes into this garden? And it's so fitting that as the fall had its origin in the Garden of Eden, the cure, which is Christ, for that enormous calamity is found at the Garden of Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives, where there was an olive press used to crush the olives and extract from them oil. And that oil was used, that olive oil was used ceremonially for all the things that they did in the temple, the anointing oil and whatnot that they used through the Old Testament was olive oil. And so much that's presented as a metaphor in the Old Testament is presented here as a fulfillment of those types. Christ is about to be crushed, just as those olives would be crushed. And here not too long ago in Norm's Wednesday night teachings, he was in Zechariah 14, and he read in Zechariah 14:4, "And his feet shall stand that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst, therefore thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley, and half the mountain shall remove to the north, and half of it toward the south." And the gist of that message was that the gospel is just going to create a division, and some are going to go this way, and some are going to go that way, and the God is the determining factor in which way they go there. And so very significant that we find him on the Mount of Olives fulfilling the very gospel that turns out to be the big divider. Our last lesson was called the Sword of Division, and talked about that effect that the gospel has on folks. And there he is in this garden, and this significant olive press there. And Isaiah 53:10 tells us, "Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer." Though this is the NIV translation that I'm reading here. It says in the KJV, it says bruise him, but if you look up bruise, it means to crush. to pound, to crush. So it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. Though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. The very determinate will and counsel of God was responsible for what was about to take place. And there's so much in the Old Testament that talks about the things that happened to him. In Isaiah 63:1, who is this that cometh from Edom? Well, remember that the temple had been revamped by an Edomite. Isn't that an interesting thing that the ruler over Jerusalem was an Edomite, Herod, and he built the temple up to suit himself, not according. He didn't get any instructions from God to do that or what to do, but he gold plated it and fixed it all up and made it a tribute to himself. But who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thy garments like him that treadeth in the wine fat? So I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment. You know, it's interesting that we read this account in Luke, and he says, you guys stay here, I'm going to go over here a stone's throw by myself and communicate. And we're going to just look at this a little bit more here in depth, but he's going to communicate with the one that he was one with from eternity. He's going to talk to God the Father. And, you know, so often we think, well, you know, unless we dial one and then the number, we don't get God. But his prayer was just instant communication with him, and the things that were on his heart, that's what he transmitted in his heart to God the Father. And we have that example there. And again, in Genesis 49:10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be, binding his foal to the vine, and his ass's colt unto the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. He said, I'll stain all my raiment. It says he was in such agony in prayer, and we're going to look at what that really has to do with. But he was just sweating like great drops of blood to the ground. The text tells of the agony that Jesus suffered there, and it's an agony that we can never fully comprehend. For right off the bat, there's nobody in this world that's not experienced sin, that's not a sinner. So we all have that viewpoint. We have that nature. We have that background, that context for everything that impacts us. But Jesus did not have that. He who knew no sin, he who was holy and harmless, and yet we find him taking on himself the sins of all his people. Can you imagine? We just can't fully comprehend what that would be like. We just don't have anything to compare that to. That him that was so holy, so pure, so righteous, and yet taking on the sins of all his people from all time, and bearing them. You know, in Matthew 26:38, it says he was sorrowful, even unto death. That's how bad it was for him. In his human form, he was sorrowful even unto death. And that's pretty serious. An agony and a sorrow for the Holy One taking and bearing all the sins of all his people. Sin, which was unbelievably opposite to his holy nature. And it must have been so reprehensible to him. But it says, yet for the joy that was set before him, he willingly did that. And because of the love that he had for the people from before the foundation of the world, the everlasting love that it talks about in Jeremiah. He made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. The great transaction of the gospel. There was an agony in which the work before him was so intense as to cause him to sweat, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground. You can imagine what, you know, you go out and do a hard day's work and you come home and your shirt is just sopping wet and it's a darker color than it was when you put it on. It's all wet and it takes on a whole new appearance. You know, he had an agony of taking on the weight in Hebrews chapter 12:1. It says, wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witness, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. This weight means a burden that's so big it's just bulging out. It's like a sack's got so much stuff in it that it's just bulging over and hanging over the sides, and it's not manageable very good by a human. And he took all that on him. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. And as we're reading this, if we were to say, okay, here's the chronology of things, he's just hours away. Just hours away. Just minutes away. And from the thing that he had been prepared from eternity to accomplish. You know, he's only a little time away from being smitten by God. Can you imagine? Someone that you just love unconditionally and who unconditionally loves you back, being that set aside for a time, separated as it were, and then being smitten by that one that you were at unity with and were at one with, and that you had an eternal love with. And so he's within a few hours of being smitten by God. In Isaiah 53:3, he's despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. That weight, that big bulging mass of burden of sin that we could never take care of. And we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. He knew that was coming because this it caused this to be written down in Isaiah 53. I remember, I don't want to go down too far down a rabbit hole, but probably many of you have behaved badly when you were a youngster and knew that you were going to get whopped when your dad came home and made yourself scarce. Because you knew it was coming and you dreaded it, you know. So I think to a certain extent, he for the joy that was set before him, endured all this, but it was a terrible agony to him to have that happen to him by God the Father. An agony of impending separation from him with whom he was at one. An agony in which we find an angel coming down. It says an angel came and strengthened him. And that word strengthen means to put strength into. He put strength into him for the things that were about to happen. And then we have a little bit about the prayer, and we're going to stop there for today and kind of pick this up in our next lesson when we have a little bit more time. But the prayer. If thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. Isn't that what he said when they said, teach us to pray? And he says, well, that's what he said. Not my will, but thine be done, as it is so in heaven, let it be on earth. So we'll stop there, and Lord willing, next time we get together, we'll tackle more of this.